All right. Welcome to the first edition of the Digital Underground podcast. It's been a little while since I've done one of these, and I'm sort of excited to get back into it. And I really think we're kicking it off on a good note here with our first guest, Paul Judge. If you're not familiar with Paul, I'm not sure where you've been in the security industry for the last few years, but Paul was first sort of came around as the CTO of Cipher Trust, one of the pioneering mail security companies from the early part of this decade. And then he was one of the brains behind the company's trusted source reputation system. And after Secure Computing bought Cipher Trust a few years ago, Paul was the CTO over at Secure Computing for a while before leaving to start his new company, PureWire, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. I'll let Paul give us sort of the lowdown on PureWire as we go. We're going to talk about a few other topics as well. So let's bring Paul in. Paul, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm great. How about you?
I'm doing well. Thanks a lot for joining me. I appreciate it.
Good to be here.
All right. So I think maybe the last time I saw you was at Black Hat last year when PureWire was just sort of getting things going. Tell me a little bit about where the idea for the company came from and then maybe a little bit about the technology itself behind PureWire.
Certainly. So you're right. That is about the last time we saw each other. And you know, PureWire was something that came to mind. After you mentioned, we spent the last, you know, first part of this decade, from 2000 to 2006, we spent, you know, fighting email security problems at Cipher Trust. And you know, what we realized is as we got better, the industry got better at fighting the email application problems, and more people deployed email security appliances and services and so forth, you know, that channel to reach users, for attackers to reach users, became much more difficult. And, you know, the attackers start to look around and say, well, you know, what are the other ways that I can get to users? And as you know, if a user on their computer is not in front of an email client, this is the second most popular thing, become the first most popular thing they're doing today, is they have a web browser open. And so the attackers realize this hole, realize that, well, while email has become more secure the last 6 to 7 years, you know, the web has been so many changes, you know, that are making the web a interesting playground for them. And so we saw this trend that was happening. We started to dig into, well, what exactly is happening in the web security space? And, you know, a few things we noticed were in those years there have been significant advances on the web. I mean, the growth of the web, the emergence of user-generated content, Ajax-based applications, all this goodness. But at the same time, it really had disrupted the way that the industry was securing users online. It was really disrupting the traditional forms of doing, you know, web security. And so we saw this gap. We saw this gap between where the problem and the threat was and kind of where the industry's solutions were. And this is what would cause us to get together, to get the band back together and start PureWire.
All right. And so how have things been going so far? I mean, there's been a lot of sort of talk about the hosted model or cloud model. Have you guys benefited from that so far?
Absolutely. In two ways. I mean, one is, you know, certainly there's a lot of interest, and because it's a popular term nowadays to move things into the cloud. But I think there's two kind of areas where we're gaining benefit. I mean, one from a business side. If you think of, you know, certainly the broader downturn that we're in as a country and world right now, people are looking for ways to kind of reduce their costs, change their expenditure habits, and, you know, moving the web security functionality into the cloud, into a service, actually helps them do that. So, you know, that's one way we've benefited from it from the business perspective, and our customers have benefited from it, is, you know, it helps them get the same security or more for less than what they're spending. But, you know, what's probably more interesting for this conversation is there are, you know, truly some technical advantages in delivering web security as a service. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, for example, email security as a service, a lot of the benefits there are really around the cost and management. But when, right, we look at web security, we actually gain some technical benefits by, you know, performing that functionality out in the cloud.
So what are those benefits? I mean, we've heard, you know, going back to the days of Qualys, which I think was maybe the first, you know, software as a service security company that I can remember. There was everybody loved the idea, but there seemed to be a little bit of, you know, hesitance about sort of offloading those security functions to somebody else. But it seems like that might be going away these days.
No, I think that's absolutely going away. It's interesting. When we were, delivering email security appliances to market, and we were competing against companies that did email services, we used to tell customers, are you sure you want to do that? Have your email out there. And it worked for a while. And then, you know, people start to open up to it. And nowadays, you know, we saw the shift of people not only being open to it, but, you know, looking for it and seeking it out. So companies have become very, open to moving services, the security services to the cloud. And I sit with, you know, CIOs of many that have decided everything that I can move to the cloud, I will. They're no longer afraid of their customer data, their enterprise data on being out there. They've become very comfortable that the companies like us have done the necessary things to secure their data. But when you mention Qualys, for example, you know, one advantage they get, technical advantage, and being out in the cloud is they get a view, an external view of a company's network.
Right.
So it's very beneficial. You're doing vulnerability assessment to get that view from the outside of what the attacker has. So that's another example of, you know, a security function that gains technical capabilities by being outside of the network. In the case of what we do, the web security service, you know, a couple of things. What happens is most of the organizations that we deal with, they have something in place like URL filtering at the gateway. Mm-hmm. And that's great when people are within the four walls of the company. But you look at people that pick their laptop out and go across the street to a coffee shop or go across the country to a hotel, you know, typically they don't have that same protection. They don't have that same control for their remote users. And the other change that's happened is over the last year or two has become, you know, more practical to browse the web using your phone, whether it, you know, be your iPhone or BlackBerry or so what have you. And so now we're seeing a number of organizations that are saying, well, how do I gain control over that? How do I have that same policy, that same security when my users are browsing the web on their mobile devices? And so for those two problems, the SaaS gives us a great benefit in that we can always be in between the user and their destination, no matter where that user is in the world, since, you know, all the functionality is there in the cloud.
Okay, and it seems like with the shift these days to a lot of the malware and attacks being online as opposed to the old email days, that's got to be a benefit because users, I don't think, are still as well trained as maybe we should be to, you know, not click on links that, you know, don't look right or things like that. Or even, you know, with some of these SQL injection attacks we've seen over the last year, you can go to a legitimate website that's, you know, you go to every single day and still get attacked. So, you know, having that buffer is probably a big advantage.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the, you know, the one of the biggest challenges is that, you know, the fact that, you know, good sites go bad. Right. So, you know, the traditional technology of URL filtering was great at telling you the intention of a site.
Right.
But it wasn't so good at telling you the reality of a site.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being in the middle and being right there to make that request on behalf of the user, we can see, you know, yes, you're going to this magazine site, you're going to this college's site, but right now it's not safe to go there because here's what's happening in the background that you can't see with the naked eye. So it's absolutely a different point of view that we have to help protect users in a different way.
Okay. It seems like in the last, maybe 6 months or so, there's been, the sort of cloud computing thing has just really taken off, at least in terms of the recognition it's gotten, you know, in the media maybe. And there's been a lot of debates about, you know, whether cloud services are inherently more secure than or less secure than traditional networks and all of that sort of back and forth. That seems to kind of miss the point to me, though. I mean, one isn't necessarily more secure than the other. Isn't it sort of all in the details and how it's deployed and how things are used?
Yeah, absolutely. I think of it like code medicine, right? It's the liquid and the capsule don't really, it's not the form factor. It's really the ingredients that are on the inside that matter. So, you know, some people like to take the liquid. Some people like the capsule. Some like the tablet. So the form factor doesn't matter. It's making sure you have the right ingredients on the inside. So I think you're right. People need to focus more on, you know, don't just go SaaS because it sounds good, but make sure you have the right security ingredients on the inside. But yeah, I mean, some of the advantages in being able to do things in the middle is, you know, in the past, we needed to protect users from malicious code. You know, malicious code meant a download. It meant an executable.
Right.
Because that's how software was delivered. And we could, in the past, you run antivirus scan on that file. You run an anti-malware heuristic scan on that file. But in today's world, an application does not mean that there's a file that's been downloaded. It does not mean there's an executable. Application can be a web app, and that runs in the browser. And the point is, an application could be a series of XML HTTP requests between somebody's browsers and a website. And traditional antivirus doesn't have an opportunity to scan a file because there is not one. And anti-malware doesn't have an opportunity. So to protect a user from, you know, today's web apps, whether they be safe or malicious, and making that decision for a user, there's a need to actually be in the middle and be aware of, you know, all of that Ajax activity that is happening. So, you know, those are the types of things. If you're looking at a service, you're saying don't do it just because it sounds good, but, you know, make sure we're actually taking advantage of these new opportunities we have as a service to protect users in a different way.
Right. What's the profile of the customers that you guys are seeing who are interested in these kind of services right now? Is it sort of run the gamut from small businesses all the way up to large enterprises, or is there kind of a particular profile that you're looking for?
Well, to be frank with you, Dennis, what we thought when we started PureWire is that, you know, we would have, you know, more significant demand from you know, smaller companies to begin with. And then over time, you know, larger companies would be more interested. But what we're seeing is a rapid amount of interest in the SaaS from both sides of that spectrum. And for two different reasons. For small companies, these are companies that they could not afford with you know, in terms of time or money, they could not afford a web security appliance, a web security software in the past. So, you know, they were, you know, riding along, living along in life unprotected. Yep. And now they have an opportunity to, say, for their 20 users or for their 30, 50 users, 100 users, they have opportunity for, you know, whether it be $30 a month or so to subscribe and have protection. And, you know, that's something that they can afford and make sense. So we have, you know, some customers that are literally three-person retail organizations, little boutiques, small gyms. In the past, these people would not have had the opportunity to deploy web security service. So that's exciting to me, to be able to deliver to those small businesses. On the other end of the spectrum, you look at some of the largest enterprises in the world, you know, they have a different motivation. One of their motivations is they have, you know, dozens of branch offices. And what they're doing right now, many of them, they have to make a decision of, do I backhaul all that traffic back to headquarters and then scan it? Or do I go and put appliances out in these 100 locations? And they're looking at SaaS to solve this problem for them of, I don't want to put appliances everywhere, but I don't want to backhaul all this traffic. And so for them, it's, oh, if you're in the middle, I can just reroute my outbound web traffic from these branch offices to your cloud and, you know, save that headache, save that investment, save that management cost. So, you know, that's kind of is what is attracting some of the very large customers right now.
Okay. All right. And you expect that to continue. I mean, the thing I wanted to get to, what's the, how does compliance play into that outsourcing model? Do you get that question from prospective customers about, you know, how is this going to affect my PCI status or, you know, whatever other regulations they have to deal with, in terms of audits and that kind of thing?
We do. It's a very common question and a legitimate question. So, you know, for that, we were able to walk through, kind of what we're doing as far as you know, SAS 70 data centers and how we actually are helping increase their compliance, because in many of these cases they have these you know, huge gaps in their deployment right now. All their remote users, they're supposed to get onto the SSL VPN and have the traffic come to the network, but it's hard to force, you know, road warriors to always log into SSL VPN when they're in a coffee shop. And so they have these gaps right now that they're aware of, and these mobile devices that have no protection, they have no awareness of when someone's going to a personal webmail site from a coffee shop and uploading spreadsheets, or when someone's using a social networking site and talking about kind of private cases to their friends. So, you know, I think we get through that first level of conversation about here's what we're doing to ensure our compliance, and then here's what we're able to do to help you even increase yours from where you were in the past. Because, you know, many of these cases, you look at, 85% of the large companies, they've deployed URL filtering, right? And that's kind of their definition of web security. But, you know, URL filtering was built at a point in time when it was about controlling your users, right? Not protecting your users.
Right.
And now they realize that there's this gap. So I think it's part of the answer of, yes, here's what we do to have our data centers be compliant, but here's further what we can do to help your overall posture improve.
Okay. And you mentioned the social networking side of things. I know you guys are sort of working on that angle on the security thing as well, because that just seems to me, and you know, a lot of other people have talked about this as well, it's just a huge sort of problem waiting to happen. We've already seen some problems on the social networks, but mostly in terms of sort of worms and that kind of thing. But the intellectual property theft ramifications, all of that kind of thing, corporate espionage, just seems to me to be a huge issue with all of these, even the ones that are built for businesses, you know, LinkedIn or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just two sides of it. There's the data leak problem, as you mentioned. I mean, just intentionally or unintentionally, people like to talk about what they're working on,
right,
with their friends. So, you know, I've seen cases of, you know, people in a hospital talking about a famous client or patient that came in on Facebook. You know, a nurse, and look, guess who came into the hospital today? Well, you can't do that.
Right.
So, you know, I've seen, you know, software developers saying, hey, I'm working on, you know, this new engine. Like, well, your competitors are watching. Don't say that.
Right.
And so being able to help an organization kind of have some visibility into, you know, the outbound traffic in these web apps and have some control over that, that's one side of, you know, kind of why social networking becomes, you know, more relevant for web security. The other side is, whether we're talking about social networking communities, like you said, like Facebook and MySpace and so forth, or if you're talking about the other user-generated content destinations online, like a Wikipedia, like a Flickr, like a YouTube, so much of the content on the web today, and you, depending on what numbers you look at, you know, about half of the top 100 sites are based on user-generated content. The problem is that there are good users, but there are also bad users.
Yep.
And when you have this distribution platform where users can create the content and distribute to others, you know, wouldn't you like to know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are?
Sure.
So before you interact with them, you have some understanding of, is it safe to collaborate with this person, communicate with this person? Is it safe to engage in commerce with this person? And that's been a gap. If you look at where web security has come from, it's really been about the places that people are visiting. It's been about the things that are running. There hasn't been much work in the community around the people, around understanding user reputation and safeguarding users from unwanted users in a web context. And as user-generated content has become so central to the web today, I think that's an interesting problem as a community we're going to have to keep working on. So, yeah, we've been having some good results and working on that for the past year, but it'd be interesting to see kind of where the industry takes this.
Yeah, I think so, too, because, I mean, we mentioned the stuff that you did at CipherTrust with Trusted Source, and there were a bunch of other those kind of reputation systems at the time that, you know, I think together had a pretty big effect on the amount of junk mail that we all saw. You know, it really reduced it, I think, in the long run. Do you think there's a way for that kind of reputation type stuff to be applied to the user-generated content and these new these new venues that we're all seeing?
Absolutely. What's exciting about that email-based IP address reputation was, when we started doing that in 2003 or so, we looked up and we were able to block 20% of the bad stuff. And we were excited. And
yeah.
Then we looked up, and about 4 years later, 2006, we were blocking 93% of the bad stuff just based on IP reputation.
Mm.
And so you think of the impact that made to a customer's network. And, we were doing it, our peers over at Ironport were doing it, other companies, posting and so forth. So the entire industry, we made an impact on the problem because we decided that we're not going to wait to look at the content, but we were going to make decisions based on the user reputation when they knocked on the door. Now, I absolutely think that the same approach is going to be meaningful in the web security world. So we've been working on this. We launched a view of this in a form of a website called purewiretrust.org. But it gives a view into being able to look at these user reputations and user identities on different social communities and understand kind of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And there's some interesting ways that we're able to do this. I mean, for example, if you look at some of these fake accounts that the attackers are making by the hundreds and by the thousands on different communities, they don't have some of the same properties that a legitimate people have. I mean, so for example, your community and your friends, and you probably have a group of friends from the workplace, you probably have a group of friends from college, wherever and when that was, and you probably have a group of people that found you from middle school. But your social graph, it follows you chronologically, it follows you geographically.
Right.
And there's this natural human order to it. But the attackers' profiles, these fake profiles that are generated, they don't have that same natural progression. So there's a number of interesting techniques that we're able to use to really separate out the real from the fake, the good from the bad. So it'll be interesting to look up in a few years and see kind of how important this new form of the user reputation is in the entire arena of web security.
Okay. So one of the great things I think about the internet is this whole idea of the anonymity, both good and bad. It allows people to say, things maybe they wouldn't have the courage to say otherwise, political free speech, all that kind of stuff. But it's also, caused a lot of problems in security, with trying to trace back attacks and all of that kind of thing. Do you think we're getting to the point where we kind of need to eliminate some of the anonymity on the internet at this point?
Not so much directly eliminate it. I think the key is, how do you maintain that, but I also kind of have the ability to do identity mapping so that if you do good things, you can take credit for them. And if you do things that are not good, we can kind of realize that, track that, and attach a reputation to that. And so I think there's these a couple different use cases. For legitimate users, they want their identity to be known, their reputation to be known in a certain context, so that this is really your blog, or this is really your Facebook page, or this is really your Twitter feed. You want to be able to claim those and have people know that it's you.
Right.
And so that your goodness from one community you can carry over to the next. So if you've been a great eBay seller for years and now you want to go sell things on Craigslist, you deserve to be able to take that reputation with you. If you have a number of friends and followers in one community, you deserve to be able to take that with you. In the physical world, you're able to do that. Your reputation, your good reputation follows you from one company to the next.
Sure.
In the electronic world, it's difficult right now to be able to have that portable reputation. And so I think we focus on that particular use case. It's not so much a challenge of anonymity. People really want to claim their identity and be able to have their reputation be portable. So I think that in itself is a large problem that needs work.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's everything I've got for you, Paul.
Okay.
I appreciate your time as always, and look forward to seeing you around this year. You're going to be out at the conferences talking things up.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be on the road. I'm sure I'll see you in a few weeks at RSA. We have a couple talks there. So yeah, enjoy speaking with you again. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Take care.